froze. Between her and the front door stood a coyote. But this was like none of the coyotes her grandfather had pointed out to her. None of those had been even as big as Patrick. But this shaggy yellow animal was the size of a wolf. Patrick had not seen or heard the animal approach, and now he seemed almost too shocked to react. Patrick, who had leapt to battle a mountain lion, now seemed cowed and uncertain. Lana's grandfather had lectured her on desert animals. The coyote that was to be respected but not feared, the lizards that would startle you with their sudden bursts of speed, the deer that were more like large rats than like Bambi, the wild burros so different from their domesticated brothers, and the rattlesnakes that were no threat so long as you wore boots and kept your eyes open.
"Shoo!"
Lana yelled and waved her hands as her grandfather had taught her to do if she ever came too close to a coyote. The coyote didn't move. Instead, it made a sharp yipping sound that caused Lana to jump back. Out of the corner of her eye, she saw dark shapes rushing toward her, three or four of them, swift shadows. Now Patrick reacted. He growled menacingly, bared his teeth and raised his hackles. But the coyote didn't move, and his companions were approaching fast. Lana had been told that coyotes were not dangerous to humans, but there was no way to believe that now. She dodged to the right, hoping to fake out the coyote, but the animal was far too quick to be fooled.
"Patrick, get him!"
she urged helplessly. But Patrick wasn't going any further than growling and putting on a show, and in seconds the other coyotes would arrive, and then... well, who knew what then? Lana had no choice. She had to reach the cabin. She had to reach the cabin or die. She yelled at the top of her voice and ran straight at the coyote in her path. The animal recoiled in surprise. There was a flash of something small and dark, and the coyote yelped in pain. Lana was past him in a heartbeat. 10 steps to the cabin door. 10, 9, 8, 7, 6. Patrick ran ahead of her, panicked, and shot inside. Lana was on his heels, spun and slammed the door shut without even slowing down. She skidded to a stop, turned, ran back to the door, and threw herself against it. But the coyotes did not pursue. They had other problems. She heard wild yelping, canine cries of pain and rage. After a while, the yelping slowed, slurred, and finally stopped. A new coyote voice set up a wild howling, howling at the moon. Then silence. In the morning, with the sun bright and all the night's terrors banished, Lana found the coyote dead, 100 feet from her door. Still attached to its muzzle was half a snake with a broad, diamond-shaped head. Its body had been chewed in half, but not before the venom had flowed into the coyote's bloodstream. She looked for a long time at the snake's head. It was a snake, without any doubt. And yet she was sure she had seen it fly. Lana put that out of her mind. And along with it, she dismissed the whisper she had heard, because flying snakes and whispering coyotes the size of Great Danes, well, none of that was possible. There was a word for people who believed impossible things. Crazy.
"I guess Grandpa wasn't that big an expert on desert wildlife after all," she said to Patrick.
19. 132 hours, 46 minutes. "You don't have to like the dude, brah, but he's doing good stuff. Quinn was poised to knock on the door of their third house that morning. It was Sam and Quinn and a Coates kid, a girl named Brooke. They were Search Team 3. It was day 8 of the phase, the 5th day since Kane had moved in and taken over, the 2nd day since Sam had kissed Astrid beside a freshly dug grave. Kane had organized 10 search teams to move through the town, each covering a square block to start. The idea was to go into each house on each of the 4 streets that formed the block. They were to make sure the stove was off, the air conditioning was off, the TV was off, interior lights were off, and the porch lights lit. They were to turn off automatic irrigation systems and turn off hot water heaters. If they couldn't figure any of that out, they would add it to a list for Adelio to follow up on. Adelio always seemed able to figure out mechanical things. He was running around Perdido Beach with a tool belt and 2 Coates kids as helpers. The search teams were also able to search for lost kids, babies who might have been abandoned, might be trapped in cribs, and pets, too. In each house, they made a list of anything useful, like computers, and anything dangerous, like guns or drugs. They were to note how much food there was and collect all the medicines so they could be sent to Dara. Diapers and formula went to the daycare. It was a good plan. It was a good idea. Kane had some good ideas, no question. Kane had tasked Computer Jack to come up with an emergency communication system. Computer Jack had the idea of going old school. He'd set up shortwave radios in the town hall, the fire station, the daycare, and the abandoned house Drake used for himself and some of his sheriffs. But Kane had taken no action against Ork. Sam had gone to him to demand action.
"What am I supposed to do?" Kane had asked reasonably. "Bet was breaking the rules, and Ork is a sheriff. It was a tragedy for everyone involved. Ork feels very bad."
So Ork still prowled the streets of Perdido Beach. For all Sam knew, Bet's blood was still on the bully's bat. And now the fear of the so-called sheriffs was magnified 10 times over. "Let's just get this over with," Sam said. He wasn't going to get into a discussion of Kane in front of Brooke. He assumed the 10-year-old was a spy. In any case, he was in a foul mood, because one of the houses they were to visit later was his own. Quinn knocked. He rang the bell. "Nada." He tried the door. It was locked. "Bring on the hammer," Quinn said. Each search team had a wagon, either taken from the hardware store or borrowed from someone's yard. They carried a heavy sledgehammer in the wagon. It had taken them 2 hours to deal with the first 2 houses. It was going to be a while before every home in Perdido Beach had been searched and rendered safe. "You want to do the hammer?" Sam asked, deferring to Quinn.
"I live for the hammer, bruh."
Quinn hefted the hammer and swung it against the door, just below the doorknob. The wood splintered, and Quinn pushed the door back. The smell hit them hard.
"Oh, man, what died in here?" Quinn said, like it was a joke.
The joke fell flat. Just inside the door, on the hardwood floor, lay a baby's pacifier. The 3 of them stared at it.
"No, no, no, I can't do this," Brooke said.
The 3 of them stayed on the porch, no one willing to go in. But no one was willing to close the door and just walk away either. Brooke's hands were shaking so badly, Sam reached for them and held them in his.
"It's okay," he said. "You don't have to go in."
She was chubby, freckled, with straw-dry reddish hair.
She wore the coat's uniform and had seemed, up until this moment, almost a cipher. She never joked or played around, just did what she was supposed to do, following Sam's lead.
"It's just after Coates,"
Brooke said.
"What about Coates?" Sam asked.
Brooke flushed.
"Nothing. Just, you know, all the adults disappearing."
Then, feeling like she had to explain some more, she said,
"It's like, I don't want to see any more creepy stuff, okay?"
Sam shot a significant look at Quinn, but Quinn just shrugged and said,
"There's like a dead little kid in there. We don't have to go inside to know that."
Sam yelled, "Is there anyone in there?" as loud as he could. Then to Quinn, "We can't just ignore this."
"Maybe we should just report it to Kane," Quinn said.
"I don't see him going house to house," Sam snapped. "He's sitting on his butt acting like he's the emperor of Perdido Beach."
When no one took the bait, Sam said, "Give me one of the big garbage bags."
Quinn peeled one off. 10 minutes later, Sam was done. He dragged the bag with its sad contents across the carpet to the front door. He hefted it by the drawstrings and carried it out to the wagon.
"Like taking out the trash," Sam said to no one.
His hands were shaking. He felt so angry he wanted to hurt someone. He felt angry enough that if he could have gotten his hands on whoever caused all this, he would have choked the life out of them. Mostly, Sam was angry at himself. He had never really known this family. It was a one-parent home, the mom and various boyfriends, and the little boy. The family weren't friends or even acquaintances, but still, he should have thought to check on the baby. That should have been his first thought. He should have remembered, but he hadn't. Without looking back at Quinn and Brooke, Sam said, "Open some windows. Let some air in there. We can come back when it's not so... when the smell is gone."
"Bruh, I'm not going in there," Quinn said.
Sam quickly closed the distance between them. Seeing his face, Quinn took a step back. "I picked the baby up and stuffed him in a trash bag, all right? So go in there and open the windows. Do it."
"Man, you really need to step off," Quinn said.
"I don't take orders from you."
"No, you take them from Kane," Sam said.
Quinn stuck his hand out, almost taunting.
"I'm sorry, am I annoying you? Why don't you just burn my hand off, magic boy?"
Sam and Quinn had had many arguments over the years, but since the coming of the phase, especially since Sam had told Quinn the truth about himself, simple disagreements had turned quickly poisonous. They were in each other's faces now, like they might both start swinging. Sam was mad enough to.
Brooke said,
"I'll do it, Sam."
Sam, his face still just inches from Quinn's, said,
"I don't want it to be this way between us."
Quinn relaxed his muscles. He forced a grin.
"No big thing, bruh."
To Brooke, Sam said, "Open the windows. Then go tell Adelio to dig another hole. I'll go do my house. It would be nice if you could pull the wagon downtown. But if you can't, I'll understand." Without another word to Quinn, he stormed off, but stopped short at the end of the walkway. "Brooke, see if you can find a picture of him and his mom, okay? I don't want him to be buried alone. He should have..." He couldn't say any more.
Eyes half-blinded by unexpected tears, he marched down the street and stumbled up the steps to his own home, the house he hated, and slammed the door behind him.
It took a while before he even noticed his mother's laptop computer was gone. He went to the table. He touched the tabletop right where the laptop had been, as though to reassure himself he wasn't imagining things. Then he noticed the open drawers, the open cabinets. The food hadn't been taken, just tossed around, some of it ending up on the floor. He bolted for his room. The light was still there. His weak attempt at camouflaging it had been torn down. Someone knew. Someone had seen. But it didn't stop there. In his mother's bedroom, the drawers and the closet had been ransacked. His mother kept a locked, flat, gray metal box in her closet. Sam knew because she'd pointed it out to him on more than one occasion.
"If anything ever happens to me, this is where my will is."
She was very serious, but then she'd say,
"You know, in case I get hit by a bus."
"We don't have any buses in Perdido Beach," he'd pointed out.
"I guess that explains why they're never on time,"
she'd said, and then laughed and hooked him in for a hug. Holding on to him, she had whispered,
"Sam, your birth certificate is in there, too."
"Okay."
"It's up to you whether you want to see it."
He had stiffened against her embrace. She was offering him a chance to know what it said on the birth certificate. There would be three names listed. His mother's, and his father's. "Maybe. Maybe not," he had said. She held him tightly, but he gently disengaged and stood apart from her. He wanted then to say something, to apologize for what had happened to Tom, to ask her whether he had also, somehow, scared off his true father. But his was a life with secrets, and even though his mother had made the offer, Sam knew she didn't want him to violate the code of secrecy. For months, Sam had known about the box, known where he could find the key. Now, the box was gone. He had very little doubt who had taken it, who had searched the house. By now, Kane knew that Sam had the power. He retrieved his bike. Right now he wanted desperately to be with Astrid. She would make sense of everything. Most kids now got around on bikes, not always their own, or skateboards. Only the Prees walked. And as he crossed through the plaza on his way to Astrid's home, there was a procession of them walking right across the street. Brother John was in the lead. Mother Mary was pushing a two-seat stroller. Some girl in a coat's uniform was carrying a toddler on her hip. Two other kids, drafted for the day, were shepherding the line of some 30 or so preschoolers. They were solemn for a group of little kids, but there was at least some horseplay, enough that Mary had to yell, "Julia and Zosia, get back in line!" The twins, Emma and Anna, brought up the rear. Sam knew them fairly well, having actually gone out with Anna on a date once. Emma had a single stroller, and Anna was pushing a Ralph's grocery cart loaded with snacks and diapers and baby bottles. Sam stopped and waited for them to cross the street. They stuck to the crosswalk, which he supposed was a good thing. Best for the Prees to learn to cross the street like there might be traffic. Some kids had been doing some driving, often with bad results. Kane had the rules on that, too, now. No one was allowed to drive, except for some of Kane's people and Adelio, who theoretically might have to drive the ambulance or the fire truck, if he ever figured out how. "Sup, Anna?" Sam asked politely.
"Hi, Sam. Where have you been?"
He shrugged. "Fire station. I kind of live there now." Anna pointed at the littles marching ahead of her.
Baby duty.
Drag, Sam said.
It's okay. I don't mind it.
And she's great at it, too, Mary called back encouragingly.
I can change a diaper in under 60 seconds,
Anna said with a laugh.
Less if it's number one.
Where are you guys all going?
The beach. We're going on a picnic.
Cool. See you later, Sam said. Anna waved over her shoulder as she passed.
Hey! Wish Anna and me happy birthday, Sam!
Emma called back. Happy birthday to both of you, Sam said. He stood up on the bike's pedals and picked up speed, heading for Astrid's. He felt a little sad thinking back on his one date with Anna. She was a nice girl, but he wasn't all that interested in dating back then. That was the truth. He'd only gone out because he felt like it was required. He didn't want kids to think he was a dork. And his mother kept asking about whether he was going out, so he had taken Anna to a movie. He remembered the movie, in fact. Stardust. His mother had driven them. It was her night off. His mom had dropped them at the theater and picked them up afterward. He and Anna had gone to the California Pizza Kitchen and split a barbecue chicken pizza. Birthday? Sam jerked the bike into a sharp turn and pounded the pedals back toward where he'd passed the Prees. It didn't take long to catch them. They were just reaching the beach, all the toddlers toddling over the low seawall, laughing now as they took off their shoes and ran onto the sand, and Mother Mary, sounding just like a teacher, yelled, "Hang on to your shoes! Don't lose your shoes, Alex! Pick up your shoes and carry them!" Anna and Emma had parked the shopping cart full of snacks and diapers and bottles. Emma was unbuckling her charge from the stroller.
"Check his diaper," Mother Mary reminded her, and Emma did.
Sam threw his bike down and ran, breathless, to Anna.
"What's up, Sam?"
"What birthday?" he panted.
"What?"
"What birthday, Anna?"
It took a while for her to absorb his fear. It took a while for the reason for his fear to dawn on her.
15,
Anna said in a whisper.
"What's the matter?"
Emma asked, sensing her twin's mood.
"It doesn't mean anything."
"It doesn't,"
Anna whispered.
"You're probably right," Sam said.
"Oh my God,"
Anna said.
"Are we going to disappear?"
"When were you born?" Sam asked. "What time of day?" The twins exchanged scared looks.
"We don't know."
"You know what? No one has blinked out since that first day, so it's probably..."
Emma disappeared. Anna screamed. The other older kids took notice. The littles, too.
"Oh my God!"
Anna cried.
"Emma! Emma! Oh God!"
She grabbed Sam's hands, and he held her tight. The Prees, some of them, caught the fear. Mother Mary came over.
"What's going on? You're scaring the kids. Where's Emma?"
Anna just kept saying,
"Oh my God!"
and calling her sister's name.
"Where's Emma?"
Mary demanded again.
"What's going on?"
Sam didn't want to explain. Anna was hurting him with the pressure of her fingers digging into the backs of his hands. Anna's eyes were huge, staring holes in him.
"How far apart were you born?"
Sam asked. Anna just stared in blank horror. Sam lowered his voice to an urgent whisper.
"How far apart were you born, Anna?"
6 minutes,
she whispered.
"Hold my hand, Sam,"
she said.
"Don't let me go, Sam,"
she said.
"I won't, Anna. I won't let you go," Sam said.
"What's going to happen, Sam?"
"I don't know, Anna."
"Will we go to where our mom and dad are?"
"I don't know, Anna."
"Am I going to die?"
"No, Anna. You're not going to die."
"Don't let go of me, Sam!"
Mary was there now, a baby on her hip. John was there. The Prees, some of them, watched with serious, worried looks on their faces.
"I don't want to die,"
Anna repeated.
I don't know what it's like."
"It's okay, Anna."
Anna smiled.
"That was a nice date when we went out."
"It was."
For a split second, it was like Anna blurred, too fast to be real. She blurred, and Sam could almost swear that she had smiled at him. And his fingers squeezed on nothing. For a terribly long time, no one moved or said anything. The littles didn't cry out. The older kids just stared. Sam's fingertips still remembered the feel of Anna's hands. He stared at the place where her face had been. He could still see her pleading eyes. Unable to stop himself, he reached a hand into the space she had occupied, reaching for a face that was no longer there. Someone sobbed. Someone cried out. Other voices. Then the Prees started crying. Sam felt sick. When his teacher had disappeared, he hadn't been expecting it. This time, he had seen it coming, like a monster in a slow-motion nightmare. This time he had seen it coming, like standing rooted on the railroad tracks, unable to jump aside. 20. 131 hours, 3 minutes.
"It just happened," Drake announced.
Kane sat in his overlarge leather chair, the one that had formerly belonged to the mayor of Perdido Beach. It made him look small. It made him look very young. And to make matters worse, he was chewing on his thumbnail, which made it almost seem that he was sucking his thumb. Diana was on the couch, lying back, reading a magazine and barely paying attention.
"What happened?"
"The two girls you had me following. They both just took the big jump. They poofed, as that idiot Quinn says."
Kane jerked to his feet. "Just as I predicted. Just like I said." Kane did not seem to be happy to have been proven right. He came around from behind his desk, and to Drake's great enjoyment, snatched the magazine out of Diana's hand and threw it across the room. "You think maybe you could pay attention?" Diana sighed and sat up slowly, brushed a piece of lint from her blouse.
"Don't get pissy with me, Kane,"
she warned.
"I'm the one who said we needed to start collecting birth certificates."
Drake had made time to check out Diana's psych file the day after the phase came. But her file had been missing by then. In its place, she had left Drake's file lying open on the doc's desk and drawn a little smiley face beside the word sadist. Drake had already hated her. But after that, hating Diana had become a full-time occupation. To Drake's disgust, Kane accepted Diana's backtalk. "Yeah, that was a good idea," Kane said. "A very good idea."
"Diana's boy Sam was there," Drake said.
Diana did not respond to the provocation.
"He was holding the one girl's hand when she bugged," Drake added, "looking right into her eyes. See, the first girl goes, and they all know what's coming at that point. The second girl, she was weepy over it. I was too far off to hear what she said, but you could tell she was basically wetting herself."
"Sadism," Diana said. "The enjoyment of another person's pain."
Drake stretched his shark grin.
"Words don't scare me.
You wouldn't be a psychopath if they did, Drake. Knock it off, you two, Kane said. He slumped back in the oversized chair and started biting his thumb again. It's November 17th. I have 5 days to figure out how to beat this.
5 days, Drake echoed. I don't know what we'd do if you bugged out, Kane, Drake said.
He sent Diana a look that said he knew exactly what he would do if Kane wasn't around anymore. Computer Jack came bursting into the room in his usual flustered, goggle-eyed way, carrying an open laptop.
What? Kane snarled. I hacked it, Computer Jack said proudly.
When he got blank looks in reaction, he said,
Nurse Temple's laptop.
Kane looked nonplussed.
What? Oh, great. I have bigger problems. Give it to Diana, and get out.
Computer Jack handed the laptop to Diana and scuttled from the room.
Scared little worm, isn't he? Drake said.
Don't mess with him. He's useful, Kane warned.
Drake, what did you see exactly when the girl vacated?
The first one, I wasn't looking right at her when it happened. The second one, I kept my eyes on her. 1 minute there, the next gone.
At 1:17?
Drake shrugged.
Close enough, anyway.
Kane slammed his hand down on the desk.
I don't want close enough, you idiot! He shouted. I'm trying to figure this out! You know, it's not just me, Drake. We all get older. You'll be there someday, too. Waiting to disappear.
April 12th, just 1 minute after midnight, Drake,
Diana said.
Not that I've memorized the exact day, hour, and minute, or...
She fell silent, reading the computer screen.
What?
Kane asked. Diana ignored him, but it was clear that she had found something of great interest in the diary of Connie Temple. Diana rose with swift, feline grace and yanked open the file cabinet. She pulled the gray metal box out and placed it almost reverently on Kane's desk.
No one's opened it yet?
She demanded.
I was more interested in Nurse Temple's laptop, Kane said. Why?
Be useful, Drake,
Diana ordered.
Break this lock.
Drake grabbed a letter opener, inserted the blade in the cheap lock, and twisted. The lock broke. Diana opened the box.
This looks like a will. And, this is interesting. A newspaper clipping about the school bus thing we've all heard about. And here it is.
She held up a plastic folder protecting an elaborately printed birth certificate. She stared at it and started laughing.
That's enough, Diana, Kane warned.
He jumped up and yanked the birth certificate from her hand. He stared, frowning. Then he sat down hard, like he was a marionette and someone had cut his strings.
November 22nd,
Diana said, grinning spitefully.
Coincidence, Kane said.
He's 3 minutes older than you.
It's a coincidence. We don't look alike.
What's the word for twins who aren't identical?
Diana put her finger to her mouth, a parody of deep thought.
Oh, yeah, fraternal twins. Same womb, same parents, different eggs.
Kane looked like he might faint. Drake had never seen him like that.
It's impossible.
Neither of you knows your real father,
Diana said. Now she was playing nice, as close to sympathetic as she ever managed to be.
And how many times have you told me you don't seem to be anything like your parents, Kane?
It makes no sense,
Kane breathed. He reached for Diana's hand and after a hesitation, she let him take it.
"What are you two talking about?"
Drake demanded. He didn't enjoy being the one person not in on the joke. But they both ignored him.
"It's in the diary, too,"
Diana said.
"Nurse Temple. She knew you were a mutant. She suspected you had some kind of impossible power, and she was obviously on to some of the others as well. She suspected you of causing half a dozen injuries where no one could ever figure out a cause."
Drake barked a laugh, catching on.
"Are you saying Nurse Temple was Kane's mother?"
Kane's face blazed in sudden rage. "Shut up, Drake!"
"Two little boys born on November 22nd,
Diana said.
"One stays with his mother. One is taken away, adopted by another family."
"She was your mother, and she gave you up and kept Sam?"
Drake said, laughing in his enjoyment of Kane's humiliation. Kane swiveled away from Diana and extended his hands, palms out, toward Drake.
"Mistake,"
Diana said, though whether she was talking to Drake or Kane wasn't clear. Something slammed Drake's chest. It was like being hit by a truck. He was lifted off his feet and thrown against the wall. He smashed a pair of framed prints and fell in a heap. He made himself shake it off. He wanted to jump up and go for Kane, finish him, quick, before the freak could hit him again. But Kane was there, looming over him, face red, teeth bared, looking like a mad dog.
"Remember who's the boss, Drake,"
Kane said, his voice low, guttural, like it was coming from an animal. Drake nodded, beaten. For now.
"Get up," Kane ordered. "We have work to do."
Astrid was on the front porch with little Pete. It was the best place to get some sun. She sat in the big white wicker rocker with her feet propped up on the railing. Her bare legs were blazing white in the sunshine. She had always been pale and was never the kind of person who obsessed over a tan, but she was feeling the need for sunlight today. Days with little Pete tended to be spent indoors, and after a couple of days of that, the house was turning into a prison. She wondered if this was how her mother had felt. Did it explain why her mother had gone from spending her every day and every night devoting herself to little Pete to finding any excuse she could to dump him on anyone who would take him? The street Astrid lived on had changed in small ways since the phase. Cars sat and never moved. There was never any traffic. The lawns were all getting shaggy. The flowers that Mr. Massilio, two doors down, always kept so beautiful were fading, limp from lack of care. Flags were up on a couple of mailboxes, waiting for a mailman who was never coming. There was an open umbrella, blowing listlessly down the street, moving an inch or two at a time. A couple of houses away, some wild animal, or maybe just a hungry pet, had overturned the garbage can and spilled blackened banana peels and sodden newspapers and chicken bones down the driveway. Astrid spotted Sam, pedaling furiously on his bike. He'd said he would come by to take her to the grocery store, and she had been waiting for him with an uncomfortable mix of emotions. She wanted to see him, and she was nervous about it. The kiss had definitely been a mistake. Unless it wasn't. Sam threw his bike on the lawn and climbed the steps.
"Hi, Sam."
It was clear that he was upset. She lowered her legs and sat forward.
"Anna and Emma just poofed."
"What?"
"I was standing there. I was watching them.
I was holding Anna's hand when it happened.
Astrid rose and, without really thinking about it, wrapped her arms around Sam like she did when she was trying to comfort Little Pete. But unlike Little Pete, Sam responded to her touch by awkwardly hugging her back. For a moment, his face was in her hair, and she heard his ragged breathing close to her ear. And it seemed like they might do it again, the kissing thing. But then, both at once, they pushed away.
She was scared, Sam said. Anna, I mean. She saw Emma disappear. They were born just 6 minutes apart. So first Emma, then Anna, waiting for it. Knowing it was coming.
How horrible. Sam, come inside.
She glanced at her brother. He was playing his game, as usual. Astrid led Sam to the kitchen and poured him a glass of water. He drank half of it in a single gulp.
I have 5 days,
Sam fretted.
5 days. Not even a week.
You don't know that for sure.
Don't, okay? Just don't. Don't tell me some story about how it's all gonna be fine. It's not going to be fine.
Okay,
Astrid said.
You're right. Somehow age 15 is this line, and when you reach it, you poof out.
That confirmation seemed to calm him down. He had just needed to have the truth set out clearly, without evasions. It occurred to Astrid that this was a way she could help Sam, not just now, but in the future. If they had a future.
I was avoiding it, not thinking about it. I'd kind of convinced myself it wasn't going to happen.
He managed a wry grin. Mostly, it seemed, for her benefit. He could see his own fear reflected in her, and now he was trying to tamp it down. On the plus side, it means I don't have to worry about how depressing it's going to be having Thanksgiving here in the phase.
There may be a way to beat it,
Astrid said cautiously. He looked at her hopefully, like maybe she had an answer. She shook her head, so he said,
No one's even looking for a way out of the phase. There may be a way to escape. For all we know, there's a big, wide-open gate in the barrier. Maybe out to sea. Maybe out in the desert or up in the national park. No one has even looked.
Astrid resisted the urge to label that sentiment as grasping at straws. Instead, she said,
If there was a way out, there would be a way in. And the whole world must know what's happened. Perdido Beach, the power plant, the highway suddenly blocked. It's not like the world hasn't noticed. And they have more people and more resources than we do. They must have half the scientists in the world working on it. But here we are still.
I know. I know all that.
He was calmer now, and sat on one of the bar stools that lined the kitchen counter. He ran one hand over the smooth granite surface, as if appreciating the coolness of the stone.
I've been thinking, Astrid. What about an egg?
I'm out of eggs.
No, I mean, think about an egg. The baby chicken pokes his way out of the egg, right? But if you try to break into the egg, it all comes apart.
He did a crumbling thing with his fingertips to illustrate. When she didn't respond, he slumped and said,
It made perfect sense when I was thinking about it.
Actually, it does make a certain amount of sense,
she said. He was clearly taken aback. His eyes twinkled in a way she liked, and he smiled lopsidedly.
You sound surprised, he said.
I am a little. It may turn out to be an apt analogy.
You're only saying apt analogy to remind me you're smarter than I am, he teased. Their eyes locked. Then both looked away, both smiling with embarrassment. I'm not sorry, you know, he said. I mean, wrong time, wrong place and all, but I'm still not sorry.
You mean...
Yeah.
No, me neither,
Astrid said.
It was my first time. You know, if you don't count when I kissed Alfredo Slavin in first grade.
First time?
Well, yeah. You?
He shook his head and winced regretfully. Then he said, but it was the first time I meant it. A comfortable silence fell between them. Then Astrid said,
Sam, the eggshell thing. What you're saying is that if people outside try to penetrate the barrier wall, it might be dangerous to us. And the people outside might have figured that out. It may be that only we can safely break the barrier and emerge. Maybe the whole world is waiting, watching, hoping we'll figure out how to hatch.
She opened the cabinet above her and produced a half-empty bag of cookies. She put them on the counter and took one for herself.
It's a good theory, but you realize it's still not likely.
I know, but I don't want to just sit here and wait for the clock to tick down if there's a way out of the phase.
What is it you want to do?
He shrugged. He had a way of doing that in a way that didn't express doubt or uncertainty, but was more like a person sloughing off a heavy burden, freeing himself up to act. I want to start by following the barrier and seeing if there just happens to be some big gate. Maybe you walk through that gate and everyone's there, you know? My mom, your parents, Anna and Emma.
Teachers,
Astrid supplied. Don't ruin a happy picture, Sam said.
What happens if you do find a gate, Sam? You go through it? What happens to all the kids still in the phase?
They get out too.
You won't know for sure it's a gate unless you go through it. And once you do, there may not be a way back in.
Astrid, in 5 days, I vacate. I poof. I dig a hole.
You have to think about yourself,
Astrid said without inflection. Sam looked stricken.
I don't think it's fair to...
Whatever he had been about to say was lost, because at that moment there were two noises in rapid succession. The first was a thump coming from outside. The second was little Pete's screech. Astrid ran for the door, burst through, and found little Pete curled into a ball, shivering, howling, ready to launch a full-scale breakdown. There was a rock on the plank floor beside him. And standing on the sidewalk, laughing, were Panda, a Coates kid named Chris, and Quinn. Panda and Chris held baseball bats. Chris was also carrying a white trash bag. Inside the bag, just visible, was the logo of a new model game player.
"Did you throw a rock at my brother?"
Astrid yelled, fearless in her outrage. She dropped to her knees beside little Pete. Sam was halfway across the lawn, moving with a purposeful stride.
"What did you do, Panda?"
"He was ignoring me,"
Panda said.
"Panda was just goofing, Sam,"
Quinn said. He stepped between Sam and Panda.
"Throwing a rock at a defenseless little kid is just goofing?"
Sam demanded.
"And what are you doing hanging with this creep anyway?"
"Who you calling a creep?"
Panda demanded. He took a tighter grip on his baseball bat, but not really like he meant to start swinging.
"Who do I call a creep? Anyone who throws a rock at a little kid," Sam said, not backing down.
Quinn raised his hands, playing the peacemaker.
"Look, take a breath, brah. We were just on a little mission for Mother Mary. She drafted Panda and sent him to look for some little kid's stuffed bear, okay? We were doing a good thing."
"Doing good and stealing someone's stuff?" Sam pointed at the trash bag in Chris's grip.
"And on the way back, you figured you'd throw a rock and hit an autistic kid?"
"Hey, step off," Quinn said.
We're bringing the game to Mary so she has something for the kids to do.
Little Pete was screaming in Astrid's ear now, so she couldn't hear everything that was said, just snatches of angry words between an increasingly huffy Quinn and a coldly furious Sam.
Then Sam spun on his heel and stalked back toward her, and Quinn gave him the finger behind his back and sauntered off down the street with Panda and the Coates kid. Sam threw himself violently into a porch chair. For the 10 minutes it took Astrid to soothe her little brother and redirect him to his video game, Sam just seethed. "He's becoming useless. Worse than useless," Sam said. Then, relenting, he said, "We'll get past it."
"You mean you and Quinn?"
"Yeah." Astrid considered just keeping her mouth shut, not pushing it. But this was a talk she needed to have with Sam sooner or later.
"I don't think he's going to get over it."
"You don't know him that well."
"He's jealous of you."
"Well, of course, I am so terribly handsome," Sam said, straining to make a joke of it.
"He's one kind of person, you're another. When life is going along normally, you're sort of the same. But when life turns strange and scary, when there's a crisis, suddenly you're completely different people. It's not Quinn's fault, really, but he's not brave. He's not strong. You are."
"You still want me to be the big hero?"
"I want you to be who you are."
She remained beside little Pete, but reached out to take Sam's hand.
"Sam, things are going to get worse. Right now everyone is kind of in a state of shock. They're scared. But they haven't even realized how scared they should be. Sooner or later, the food supply runs out. Sooner or later, the power plant fails. When we're sitting in the dark, hungry, despairing, who's going to be in charge? Kane? Ork? Drake?"
"Well," he said dryly, "you make it all sound like a lot of fun."
"Okay, I'll stop nagging you,"
Astrid said, sensing that she needed to back off. She was asking the impossible of this boy she barely knew. But she knew it was the right thing to do. She believed in him. She knew he had a destiny. She wondered why. It wasn't logical, really. She didn't believe in destiny. All her life, Astrid had relied on her brain, on her grasp of facts. Now, some part of her she barely knew existed, some buried, neglected part of her mind was urging her on. No good reasons, just an instinct that kept pushing her to push him. But she was sure. Sure. Astrid turned her face toward little Pete so that Sam wouldn't see the frown of worry on her face, but she didn't release his hand. She was sure. Like she was answering 2 plus 2. That sure. She let go of his hand. She took a deep, shaky breath. And now she was not sure at all. Her frown deepened.
"Let's go get the groceries,"
Astrid said. He was elsewhere, preoccupied, so he didn't notice the way Astrid stared at her own hands, face screwed up in concentration. She wiped her palms on her shorts. "Yeah," he said. "Better go while we still can." 21. 129 hours, 34 minutes.
"Show me your list,"
Howard demanded. He was outside the front door of Ralph's grocery, seated in a lawn chair, with his feet propped up on a second chair. He had a small combo TV-DVD playing Spider-Man 3. He barely looked up as they approached.
I don't have a list,
Astrid said. Howard shrugged.
You need a list. No one goes in without a list.
Sam said, okay, do you have a piece of paper and a pencil?
It just so happens I do, Sam,
Howard said. He fished a small spiral notebook from the pocket of an ill-fitting leather jacket and handed it to Astrid. She wrote and handed it to Howard.
You can have all the fresh stuff, like produce, that you want. It's all gonna go bad. Ice cream is mostly gone, but there might be some popsicles.
He glanced at little Pete.
You like the popsicles, Petard?
Get on with it, Sam said.
If you want canned stuff, or like pasta or whatever, you have to get special permission from Kane or one of the sheriffs.
What are you talking about?
Astrid demanded.
I'm talking about you can have lettuce and eggs and deli and milk, because that's all going to expire soon. But we're saving up the stuff like canned soup or whatever that won't spoil.
Astrid admitted,
okay, that makes sense, I guess.
Likewise, paper products. Everyone gets one roll of toilet paper, so make it last.
He glanced at the list again.
Tampons? What size?
Shut up, Sam said. Howard laughed.
Go ahead on in, but I'll check everything on the way out, and if it's not okay, I'll make you put it back.
The store was a mess. Before Kane had posted a guard, it had been looted of almost all the snack foods, and the kids who had looted had not been neat or careful. There were broken jars of mayonnaise, displays turned over, shattered glass from smashed freezer doors. There were flies everywhere. The place had begun to smell like garbage. Some of the overhead lights had burned out, leaving pockets of gloom. Brightly colored posters still hung over their heads, touting specials and price reductions. Sam grabbed a cart, and Astrid lifted little Pete into the seat. The flowers in the little florist's corner were all looking tired. A dozen Mylar balloons with happy birthday or Thanksgiving messages on them still floated, but were losing altitude.
Maybe I should look for a turkey,
Astrid said, looking at the display of Thanksgiving-related food. Pumpkin pie mix, mincemeat, cranberry sauce, turkey basters, stuffing. You know how to cook a turkey?
I can find instructions online.
She sighed.
Or not. Maybe they have a cookbook around.
I guess no cranberry sauce.
Nothing canned.
Sam walked ahead into the produce section, then stopped, realizing Astrid was still staring at the seasonal display. She was crying.
Hey, what's the matter?
Astrid brushed at her tears, but more came.
Grocery shopping was always something the three of us did. My mom and Petey and me. It was a time every week when we could talk. You know, we'd shop kind of slowly and discuss what to eat and talk about other stuff, too. Just casually. I've never been in here without my mom before.
Me neither.
It feels weird. It looks the same, but it's not.
Nothing's the same anymore,
Sam said. But people still need to eat. That earned a reluctant smile from Astrid.
Okay, let's shop.
They picked up lettuce and carrots and potatoes. Sam went behind the counter to lift a pair of steaks and wrap them up in paper. Flies were thick on some cuts of meat that had been left out when the butchers disappeared, but the meat from inside the case seemed untouched. Anything else, ma'am? He asked.
Well, since no one else is taking them, I might as well take that roast.
Sam leaned down to look in the display. Okay, I give up. Which one is a roast?
The big thing there.
She tapped the glass.
I can put it in the freezer.
Of course, the roast.
Sam lifted it out and slapped it down on a sheet of waxed butcher's paper. You realize it's like $12 a pound or whatever?
Put it on my tab.
They moved on to the dairy case, and there was Panda, standing nervously and holding his bat at the ready. "You again?" Sam snapped. Panda didn't answer. Astrid screamed. Sam turned, saw just a flash of Drake Merwin before something hit the side of his head. He staggered into a shelf of Parmesan cheese, knocking the green bottles everywhere. He saw a bat swinging, tried to block it, but his head was swimming, and his eyes would not focus. His knees collapsed, and he hit the floor. As if from far off, he saw kids moving quickly, four or five maybe. Two grabbed Astrid and held her hands behind her. There was a girl's voice, one Sam didn't recognize until he heard Panda say,
"Diana, bag his hands,"
Diana said. Sam resisted, but he didn't have control of his muscles. Something went over his left hand, then his right. Strong fingers held him securely. When he could focus at last, he stared stupidly at what had been done. His wrists were lashed together with a plastic tie, and around each hand was a deflated Mylar balloon, duct-taped in place. Diana Ladris knelt down, bringing her face to his level.
"It's Mylar. It's a reflective surface, so I wouldn't try to turn on your mojo, Sam. You'd fry your own hands."
"What are you doing?"
Sam slurred.
"Your brother wants to have a nice conversation with you."
That made no sense, and Sam wasn't sure he'd heard right. The only person he ever called brother was Quinn.
"Let Astrid go," Sam said.
Drake moved past Diana and kicked Sam onto his back, legs twisted beneath him. Drake stood over him and pushed the end of his bat down against Sam's Adam's apple. The same move he had used on Ork the night before.
"If you're a good little boy, we'll be nice to your girlfriend and her retarded brother. If you cause trouble, I'll mess her up."
Little Pete had begun his wind-up to a full howl.
"Shut that kid up or I'll shut him up for you,"
Drake snapped at Astrid. Then, to Howard, Panda, and the others, he said,
"Grab the big hero here and throw him in a grocery cart."
Sam was lifted and dropped into a cart. Howard was the one pushing.
"Sammy, Sammy, Sammy. School bus Sam is grocery cart Sam now, huh?"
Drake leaned over, and the last thing Sam saw was a strip of duct tape coming down over his eyes. They pushed him down the hallway in the grocery cart. They pushed him through town. He couldn't see, but he could feel the bumps, and he could hear the laughter and taunts of Howard and Panda. Sam tried to make sense of the route, tried to figure out where they were going. After what seemed like a long time, he could feel that they were going uphill. Howard began to complain.
"Man, somebody help me push this thing! Yo, Freddy! Man, help me out!"
The cart accelerated for a while, then slowed again. Sam could hear heavy breathing.
"Get some of these people just standing around,"
Freddy demanded.
"Yeah! Hey, you! Come here and help me push this cart!"
"No, man. No way."
Quinn. Sam's heart leapt. Quinn would help. The cart came to a stop. Howard said,
"What, you afraid your boy here will find out what you've been up to?"
"Shut up, man," Quinn said.
"Sammy, who do you think gave us the heads up you were going shopping with Astrid? Huh?"